Imagine knowing, like, an absolutely priceless historical artifact exists somewhere, but the only map to find it is written in a language that changes every time you look at it.
Oh, and half the roads on that map just, vanish at midnight.
Right, exactly. Like,
Yeah.
that is the actual daily reality of digital genealogy and historical research. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We've got a massive stack of your research notes and technical documentation right here in front of us.
And today's mission is translating all of that into a masterclass on how we are teaching computers to find where human history is hiding.
Yes, because if you've ever stared at a blank search bar at 2 in the morning, just trying to track down a single ancestor, you know exactly how maddening this information overload can be.
Oh, totally. We are dissecting this highly structured metadata system known as the Max Source Schema.
Max Source.
Right. And while it was explicitly built to solve those genealogy nightmares, the architectural principles here are basically a blueprint for conquering any massive, unstructured data landscape.
Yeah, because we aren't just looking at a list of links today.
Yeah.
We are going to build essentially the ultimate information machine, step by step.
Step one, we give it a map. Step two, we give it manners.
Manners, which is huge. And then step three, the most fascinating part, we give it a brain. So,
Yeah.
okay, let's unpack this by starting with the underlying problem this whole machine was built to solve.
Right. So the documentation calls this the navigator's problem.
The navigator's problem,
Yeah.
got it.
So let's put you, the listener, in the shoes of a researcher. Let's say you were looking for a Lutheran family who lived in Württemberg, Germany in the 1840s.
Okay, very specific.
And they emigrated to America around 1848. So to prove this family's timeline, you need their German church records, right? Like baptisms, marriages, and you also need their emigration departure records.
Which sounds totally straightforward, until you realize you have to actually locate the physical, well, the digital server holding those specific documents.
Exactly. And the contrast is just stark when you look at how human experts operate versus novices. A seasoned expert instantly knows that Württemberg church records are digitized on platforms called Archeon and Matricula.
Just off the top of their head.
Right. And they know emigration records are housed in the regional state archives or maybe indexed on Ancestry. They know exactly which drips to knock on.
But if you are new to German research, I mean, you are totally lost. You end up wasting just hours clicking through broad catalog searches or reading like forum posts from 2008.
Or begging for help on a random Facebook group.
Yes. We've all been there.
So Max Source was engineered to make that seasoned expert's brain machine readable. It takes all that sprawling chaos of global archives and wikis and databases and structures their metadata.
So a system can answer, where do I find this exact type of record
Yeah.
in literally milliseconds? Okay, hold on though. I'm going to push back here a little bit.
Sure.
If I just type Württemberg emigration records, 1840s, into Google, won't I get what I need? Like, why do we need an entirely new schema when we have the most powerful search engine in the world?
Well, because you'll get a million scattered signposts. Okay. Some of those search results point to a dead link, some point to a book you have to buy, and others point to a blog post that's just talking about immigration generally.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a standard search engine matches text on a page. It doesn't fundamentally understand the structure of the data it's pointing you to.
Right.
Max Source is fundamentally different. It is a dedicated GPS routing system. It doesn't just hand you a URL.
It describes the URL like it's an actual map.
Exactly. It describes the URL, the type of source, the exact geographic and temporal coverage, and the specific access method you need to get inside.
Okay, so if it's a GPS, step one is defining the map. Every destination in this map has to be categorized. And looking at the documentation, it outlines 12 distinct source types under this primary routing signal called the source type field.
Right. And the schema doesn't just list these sources, it categorizes their required behavior.
What do you mean by required behavior?
Well, for instance, the system treats a forum completely differently than a record database.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, if a source is tagged as a forum, the routing machine knows it has to sift through like unstructured human conversations.
Right, messy text.
Exactly. But if it's tagged as a record database, the machine knows, oh, I can likely use an API to pull structured facts from this.
Got it. And you also have tags for like a directory index, which is like a curated list of links or an archive for primary documents. The tag dictates the machine's entire approach to that specific destination.
Which brings a ton of order to the chaos.
But knowing what a destination is doesn't help if you don't know what's actually inside it. Which brings us to the coverage object. And this, to me, feels like the actual engine of the map.
Oh, absolutely. The coverage object is where the filtering magic happens. It explicitly describes the places, the record types, the time periods, and even the religious groups the source contains.
Right, and the location data is deeply nested, too. Like it moves from country code down to state, down to county, and finally the specific town.
And the time period constraints are incredibly strict. The schema requires a year min and a year max.
Why is that so crucial, though? Like, why the strict bounds?
Because the stakes are incredibly high with time bounds. Going back to our 1848 Württemberg emigrants, there are beautiful, highly detailed civil registration records for Württemberg.
Okay, great.
But they legally did not begin until 1876.
Meaning our family had already been living in America for almost 30 years by the time those books were even opened.
Exactly. And without those rigid time bounds, a less sophisticated system would constantly suggest those civil records to a researcher simply because the geographic location matched.
Right. Hey, it says Württemberg here, yeah.
Yeah. And it would send you on a total wild goose chase for documents that physically cannot contain your ancestors.
I honestly think of this coverage object like a time-traveling bouncer at an exclusive nightclub.
A time-traveling bouncer. I like that.
Yeah, right. Like, if a piece of historical data doesn't fit the exact geographic and temporal VIP list for your specific query, it does not get past the door.
Yep. The system quietly filters it out, which saves the researcher days of frustration.
Okay, so that filtering is a massive efficiency gain. But step two in building our machine is manners. Because just because a computer knows a record exists behind a specific digital door, well, it doesn't mean it's allowed to just kick the door down and take it.
Right into the digital etiquette. MacSource handles this with an access object. It spells out the rules of engagement.
Like whether it's free or paid.
Exactly. Whether a source is free on the web, locked behind a paid subscription, accessible via a clean API, or if it's on-site only, where you actually have to fly to a physical building to read the paper.
But the most critical piece of this access infrastructure, which I found fascinating, is a field called crawl notes.
Yes. So a standard web crawler usually relies on a basic file called robots.txt, which is basically just a giant stop or go sign and says, you know, yes, you can crawl the site or no, you cannot.
Very binary.
Right. But crawl notes goes much deeper. It captures nuanced institutional knowledge.
The example in the notes was hyper-specific. It was something like, use API.php, batched 50 items per call with a minimum 5-second delay.
Yeah, and think about the real-world implications of that instruction. What's fascinating here is that many of these historical records are hosted by small county genealogical societies.
Or like underfunded regional archives, right?
Exactly. And if a helpful automated research tool sends 1,000 rapid-fire requests a second to a tiny server, it will unintentionally execute a distributed denial-of-service attack.
It'll just nuke the server.
It will completely crash the server. So crawl notes ensures the tool respects the physical infrastructure of that specific archive.
It prevents a helpful robot from accidentally becoming a digital battering ram. But physical servers aren't the only boundaries that need respecting, right? There is a huge intellectual property dilemma here.
Oh, massive.
The source material highlights these curated directories, and they use Cindy's List as a prime example, which, if you know, Cindy's List is a legendary, hand-curated catalog of genealogical links. It's someone's life work.
Right. A global database can't just scrape all her links, ingest them, and publish them as its own.
Because doing so would be a massive violation of intellectual property.
Exactly. And MacSource engineers a highly pragmatic solution to this with a field called the redistribution license. Specifically, it uses a tag called Tier 2 Private.
Okay, let's unpack this. How does Tier 2 Private actually work in practice?
So if the MacSource database ingests a link that was originally discovered via a third-party proprietary directory, like Cindy's List, it tags that entry as Tier 2 Private.
Okay.
Functionally, this means the routing system knows the path exists. The internal logic can use that path to find an answer for a user.
Yeah, but it doesn't show its work.
Right. That specific metadata record is never exposed in a public data set. It's stripped from public API responses, and it cannot be exported.
Wow. So the machine knows the secret shortcut, but it refuses to draw that shortcut on a public map. It just routes the user to the final destination without exposing the proprietary catalog that pointed the way in the first place.
Yeah, it's an elegant functional engineering solution to a really thorny legal problem.
Okay, so we now have a highly detailed map, and we have the manners to navigate it legally and respectfully. So step three is giving the system a brain so it can actually understand human intent.
And here's where it gets really interesting.
Yes. This is where we leave traditional databases behind completely. The documentation introduces this field called embedding text, which effectively turns this entire routing catalog into a semantic search engine.
To grasp the leap in technology here, we really need to break down two concepts, denormalization and vector databases.
Okay, lay it on me.
So, traditional databases keep information in very rigid boxes. You have a column for name, a column for date, a column for location.
Like a giant Excel spreadsheet.
Exactly. Denormalization takes all the data out of those rigid boxes and translates it into a natural language paragraph. It writes it out as a sentence.
Okay, and then?
Once it has that sentence, it feeds it into a high-dimensional vector database.
Which sounds very sci-fi.
It does. But imagine a massive three-dimensional map of human language where concepts and ideas are placed as physical coordinates. Words or ideas that mean similar things are placed physically closer together on this map.
I love this concept so much. It's the difference between playing Go Fish and playing horseshoes.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Like, a traditional database is Go Fish.
Mm-hmm.
If I ask the database for a 7 and it only has an 8, it just says Go Fish. It requires a 100% exact match.
Why exactly?
But a vector database is horseshoes. Even if my search term isn't a perfect match, the system sees that it landed right next to the peg, understands they're related, and scores the points anyway.
And that semantic proximity changes everything for historical research. Let's look at the Archan example from the notes.
Okay.
Our researcher asks the system for records for a Lutheran family in Württemberg.
So the GoFish database just looks for the exact string of letters for Württemberg.
Right, but the semantic text for the Archan database reads, Archan provides access to Protestant church books from Baden-Württemberg, Rhineland, Palatinate, and other German states. Records include baptisms from Lutheran and Reformed parishes.
So a basic computer looks at the user typing Württemberg and the database text saying Baden-Württemberg and says, no match, go fish.
Yep. But the vector database, playing horseshoes, sees the user's intent. It maps the coordinates and recognizes that Baden-Württemberg encompasses the historical region the user is actually asking about.
That's so smart.
And even more impressively, it knows that Lutheran and Protestant occupy the same conceptual space on that 3D map.
The machine understands context, and the source notes pointed out something brilliant about name variations using this exact semantic brain, too.
Oh, the spelling variations, yes. Because
historically, names change spelling constantly. A family named Miller in Germany becomes Miller in Ohio. The Irish name O'Brien becomes O'Brien. Or Maxwell is recorded as Makeswell by some, you know, tired clerk at the end of the day.
Right. And in a rigid database, tracking those changes requires manually programming thousands of sounds like rules or wildcards.
This is exhausting.
It is. But the semantic vector space bypasses that entirely. Because it was trained on vast amounts of historical text, it already knows that Muller and Miller cluster together in the context of German-American immigration.
Wow.
It bridges the gap between modern human language and historical terminology shifts effortlessly. You don't need to know the archaic phrasing a 19th century clerk used. You just ask naturally, and the vector space connects the concepts.
So we have built an incredible machine. We have a strict map, polite manners, and a semantic brain that understands context and spelling shifts. So what does this all mean? How does this culminate for the actual researcher sitting at their computer?
Well, before we see the final output, there is one last vital piece of the architecture. The system has to track how it knows what it knows.
Ah, right.
This is the provenance object. It logs which seed source found a link, who asserted it, and when it was last verified.
Which makes sense for auditing. But the detail buried in the provenance section that completely blew my mind was how the schema handles dead links.
The status dead link marker. Yeah, it is a profound design choice.
Because when a URL breaks on a normal website, the database administrator just deletes the row, right? They just sweep it under the rug. But MaxSource intentionally preserves the broken row. It flags it as dead, but keeps every single piece of metadata attached to it. Why keep the digital trash?
Because in historical research, knowing that a source actually did exist at one point is highly valuable data. It leaves a historical footprint.
Okay, I see.
By preserving the metadata of a dead link, future researchers can investigate whether a collection was moved to a new server or absorbed by a larger national archive, or if it was just permanently taken offline.
Right. It prevents that horrible phenomenon where a researcher remembers seeing a document 10 years ago, but because the link died and the record was deleted from the catalog, They are effectively gaslit by the internet into thinking it never existed.
Exactly.
It preserves the ghost of the data. Okay, so let's put the whole picture together. What is the ultimate vision of the MAC source schema in action?
The vision is a system capable of answering the question, where should I look next? Instantly, for any research problem. Let's say you are looking at a profile for your great-grandfather.
Okay.
The system flags that his birth date has a very low confidence score. It's unproven.
And at that exact moment, the MAC source routing brain activates.
Right. It analyzes the suspected birthplace and time period. It queries the vector database matching the semantic intent of finding a birth record in that specific region.
Oh, and it uses the time-traveling bouncer to filter out any databases that don't actually cover that decade.
Yes. So it gathers all the potential targets. Then it ranks them.
How does it rank them?
Well, it prioritizes access ease, knowing an open API is faster to retrieve than a scrape-only site. It prioritizes geographic specificity, knowing a local county archive is better than a broad national database. And it prioritizes record type, knowing that a baptismal register is far better proof of birth than, say, a tax roll.
So after running all that complex math in the background, it hands the researcher the top three links. And because of the semantic embedding, it actually generates a plain language explanation of why you should click them.
Exactly. You click the top link, the API pulls the document, you verify the baptism, your confidence score goes up, and the mystery is solved.
The machine acts as an impossibly fast, highly structured research assistant that just never sleeps.
It is brilliant.
We've seen today how MAC source takes the chaotic, broken world of historical records and just forces it to make sense. You know, it categorizes behavior, it uses hyper-specific time bounds to save you from dead ends, it politely knocks on archive doors without crashing servers.
Right.
And it uses vector embeddings to understand the actual meaning of your query, not just your keystrokes.
And honestly, whether you are tracking down your own ancestors or you are an engineer trying to figure out how to structure a massive influx of messy corporate data, the principles of semantic embedding, structured coverage, and explicit access etiquette are universally powerful tools to conquer information overload.
It completely changes the game.
It does. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Okay.
We talked about semantic vectors, connecting concepts, bridging the gap between names like Miller and Miller. And we talked about the profound value of preserving dead links to leave a historical footprint.
Keeping the ghosts of the data alive?
Right. So consider this. If we can use semantic vectors to map the proximity of historical concepts so accurately, and we actively preserve the metadata of digital links that have died,
yeah,
could we eventually use a schema like this to reconstruct the semantic shadow of actual physical archives that have been destroyed by fires or wars?
Oh, wow.
Right. Even if the physical papers are burned and gone forever, mapping the exact shape of the hole they left behind in the global metadata might tell us exactly what knowledge our ancestors lost.
That is wow. We started out talking about the frustration of a blank search bar. And maybe eventually this machine gets so smart it can tell us exactly what was written in the books that no longer even exist.
Something to definitely think about.
Absolutely. Catch you next time on The Deep Dive.